So I was trying to think of something to talk about, and you'll notice I have this badge around here, and you've probably noticed about 100 other people with these badges on. And that's because there's a conference going on here right now. And the name of the conference is IGST11. And this is, and what I decided I would talk about is I would sort of go through the different initials there and give you sort of a little idea of what it is we do and sort of try to connect the things together. And so probably what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about the I, then stop, and you can ask maybe if you have things to add or questions, et cetera. And then I'll move to the G and then the S and on the T. Okay, so, well, this is easy, 2011. Okay, so that's taken care of. Okay, this one is integrability. Okay, so let me just, and the rest of them are gauge and string theory. Okay, so integrability and gauge and string theory. So, let me skip a little bit ahead to the G. Okay, so a gauge theory, some of you have taken a course in quantum field theory. A gauge theory is a quantum field theory that has a spin one particle that acts, that's the carrier of the force. Okay, so QED, quantum electrodynamics, is an example of a gauge theory. The other well-known example is QCD, quantum chromodynamics. There's a difference between the two of them. Okay, QED is what's known as a weakly coupled theory, and you can use perturbation theory to basically solve it to very accurately. In fact, computations done in QED are the most accurate computations you can do in theoretical physics. You can make predictions that are valid up to, I think, 11 or 12 significant digits. So it's, in a sense, the most successful theory in theoretical physics. QCD, what's responsible for the strong force, is much less understood. And the reason for that is that it's strongly coupled. And so it is very hard to solve, although people have now managed to put it on computers and solve it on computers. And so they've made a lot of progress there. However, so it's very hard to solve. So one thing that theoretical physicists try to do is they look for other sort of gauge theories, okay, that might not be exactly QCD, okay, but are easier to solve, okay? And that's basically what this whole program is about. And I'll tell you what this other gauge theory is that we have a much better control over. And it turns out that there's some features in it that are also in QCD, so it tells you something about that theory as well. Okay, so back to integrability. So to describe integrability, I want to just tell you about a system that was first proposed in the 1920s, okay? And this is called the Heisenberg ferromagnet. Actually, it used to be called the Heisenberg-Dirac ferromagnet, but somewhere along the way, Dirac's name dropped off of it. But we'll call it the Heisenberg ferromagnet. And all it is a one-dimensional system of spins, okay, which can either be up or down or some linear combination like this. And let's say, to make life easier, let's say that this goes around in a circle and that there are L of these spins. So the Hamiltonian is given by this. Okay, there's some constant alpha. And I'm going to put an overall constant 1 inside here, minus sigma, where this is the Pauli matrix, J, dotted into sigma J plus 1. And this is a sum from J to 1 to L. Okay, so is everyone familiar with the Pauli matrices? This is okay. These are okay. So these are the Pauli matrices. And what? Sure, absolutely. It's just an overall constant. And the only reason I put it in there is because then with the overall constant, when two spins are aligned, they will give me a 1 and it'll cancel off. Okay. So you don't have to put it there. It's an overall constant, but it makes our life slightly easier, so I'll put it there. Okay, so what this is telling you then is that you have two, the spins that are next to each other, okay, interact with each other. And since this is a minus sign, okay, it's energetically favorable for the spins to line up. Okay, so that's less energy than if they're pointing the opposite way. Now, condensed matter physicists often consider the anti-ferromagnet, and what they do there is they change the sign here. Okay, in that case, then for them, they find this more interesting. Surprisingly, we were going to find that this actually has some relevance to gauge theories. Okay, so you can see then quite easily that if I have a state where all the spins are up, okay, that this is a ground state of the system, okay, because all these 1 minus sigma j dot sigma j plus 1s give me 0 at every single site in here, okay, and that's the lowest energy configuration. Actually, the total spin is conserved. Sorry, the total spin commutes with the Hamiltonian. So the actually this has total spin L, and so you know then there's actually 2 L plus 1 different ground states. But let's just consider this one where all the spins are pointing up. Okay, so that would be the ground state. So next thing you want to do is what would be an excited state. So to get an excited state, what you would do is you would flip one spin. Okay, so one spin is down and the other one is up. Okay, now Oops, that's the front. Oh, I am on the mid. Okay. Okay, so if I write this out, okay, I can write this as this is sigma 3 J plus 1, so the one in the J in the Z direction, plus sigma plus J, sigma J plus 1 minus, plus sigma J minus, sigma J plus 1 plus. Okay, so this one just is, gives you the product of the spins. This one, okay, will, if it's a downspin, will turn a downspin to an upspin on site J, and at the same time turn an upspin on J plus 1 into a downspin, okay? And this one will be give me the opposite of that. Okay, so if the two spins are the same, okay, both of these terms will give me 0 because either the sigma minus will kill the state or the sigma plus will kill the state, okay? But if the two neighboring spins are pointing in the opposite direction, then either this term will turn the downspin to an upspin at J and the upspin to a downspin at J plus 1, or if it's the other way around, this one will do it. So what this term will do is if I look at, say, this term here, these nearest neighbors here, okay, this will turn this into a state, this will turn this into this. Okay, so if I have a spin at a particular fixed site, okay, it's not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Okay, because I get a different state out when I act on it with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so does anyone have questions on what I'm saying so far? Does this sort of make sense? Okay, so that would be my downspin. Okay, so I have one downspin. Let's make that into an eigenstate. Well, the way to make that into an eigenstate is I make a sum times some e to the I p j. Okay, of the positions of that downstate spin. Okay, and this would be J, the position J. Okay, and now this would be an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. Okay, so what happens then is when I'm summing over all these different sites, if the two spins are aligned, I get 0 for all of them. But then I come to this one spot here, actually two spots. Okay, what happens then is that the one will give me back a 1, and the other one will flip these two positions of these spins, and this one will flip these two positions of the spins. And so what you'll end up with, you'll see, is that you'll get, for those two different sets of nearest neighbors, you'll get 1 minus e to the ip plus 1 minus e to the minus ip times alpha will be the energy of this state. Okay? So this you can write as 4 alpha times sine squared of p over 2. Okay, now I told you that I put this on a circle. And when you have, you can think of this spin here, which has, it has a momentum. And we call this, it's like a particle on a circle, and we call this particle a magnon. Okay? And it has a definite momentum. Now, we have this particle on a circle, and what happens when you have a particle on a circle? The momentum becomes quantized, because we know that if we translate the magnon all the way around the circle, the wave function has to come back to itself. So e to the ip dot l is equal to 1. So that means that p is equal to l, is equal to some integer n times 2 pi divided by l. Okay, so we have l different choices for the momentum. Okay. So are there any questions on that before I go on? Because now the next thing I'm going to do is put two of them on, and that's when it gets interesting. Any questions? This is an exact statement. Actually, everything, the next one will be exact too. Right? But yeah, this is a little more complicated. Not as much as it could be, but it's not so bad. what's that?
You might want to bring the middle one
down. Yeah, that's what I was. Oh, I want this one up and the other one the front, I think, as my. Okay, so now I want to add two. I want to have two magnons. So that means two downspins somewhere on there. Now, if you think about it, if the magnons, if this L is very big, okay, so I can have this very long, this is called a spin chain, this very long spin chain. I could have a downspin somewhere over here, and way, way, way down here, I have another downspin. Okay? And so for the most part, this downspin doesn't know anything about this downspin because it's very far away. So we would expect then that what we would expect is we would have, say, j less than k, I need a little room here, of e to the I p1, so the momentum of this first one, j, plus e to the I p2 k of the second one. Okay? So we would have something like this. And this would be the case where the magnon with momentum p1 is to the left of the magnon with momentum p2. Forget for now the fact that I told you that we're on a circle. Okay. And we should probably also consider the case where it's the opposite order. And we'll have to put a constant in front of that, an overall constant. So I'll still say j less than k, but now this will go with p2. P1k. And then okay. And the p1 and the j's and the k's are telling you where the downspins are on that spin chain. Well, so just by what I argued before, the energy of this state should be, the energy should be alpha times sine squared, 4 alpha sine squared p1 over 2 plus sine squared p2 over 2. Okay, but you got to be a little careful, because when we derived this formula, we always assumed that the magnon, the downspin, had an upspin on both sides of it. Okay, but there's one particular state where that's not the case, and that's when the two downspins are right next to each other. Yep? This is just some, yeah, this is, we're going to need this term, okay, in order to make this an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Well, the difference is that this has momentum. This is the one with momentum p1, here, and this is the one with momentum P2. And here it was the other way around. This is the one with P1. I could do it that way, but this covers all possible configurations that way. I could do it that way, and I just say that, you know, I just have it like this. But I will need this. I will need this term. I'm not just saying this is one, because it won't work if this is one. And then the reason why it won't work is because when two downspins are next to each other, okay, so we had something like this. When I had this contribution 1 minus EIP plus 1 minus E minus IP, one of the terms came from the downspin, came from, is there a pointer? I don't want to bring that chalkboard back down again. Okay. So one of those terms came from the downspin, the term to the left of the upspin to the left of the downspin, and the other one came from the upspin to the right of the downspin. But when the two are next to each other, this one does not have an upspin to the right of it. Okay, so that would give me zero. This one does not have an upspin to the left of it. Okay, so it changes things a little bit. In a way, okay, and you could derive this for yourself. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the way that this changes things is that this constant. What you have to do is you have to the missing pieces. The way you can fix it is the pieces that are missing. If they add up to zero, then it won't matter. Okay, so basically you choose this constant C. Okay, so that the missing pieces add up to zero. Okay, so it's not a difficult thing to do. It's something you can do back in your dorm room. So what you find is that it's actually convenient to define what's known as the rapidity. Okay, so this would be U. Okay, and we call this U. And U has the relation U plus I over 2 times U minus I over 2 is equal to E to the IP. Okay. All right. So what you find then is then that this C, in terms of these rapidity variables, will be U1 minus U2 minus I divided by U1 minus U2 plus I. Okay. So this C has to be chosen this way, otherwise it's not an eigenstate. Okay. Yep. Yeah, exactly. So I'm assuming that the wave function basically has the same form as the one magnon one, okay? And so this looks like the one magnon one, and this looks like the one. Both of these look like, these look like two magnon ones, okay? Built out of two one magnons, okay? But they have to come in a certain linear combination, okay? And the linear combination is so that it's actually still an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Okay, but now let's try to think of what this means. What this constant C means. So what we're saying is we have a magnon with momentum P1, okay, to the left of a magnon with momentum P2. Okay, that's this part of the wave function. Okay, the other way, they're like this. Okay, so what happens when you do something like that? That's when you scatter two particles. Okay, so if you remember from your quantum mechanics courses, you learn about something called an S matrix. Yes? Okay. Well, this C is the S matrix. For this theory, the C is the S matrix. Okay, so I will call this S12. The scattering, so this is giving you the S matrix for one magnon scattering off of another magnon. Okay, well, I said I would only use two boards, but maybe not. Okay, so now what does this mean for quantization? Okay, so now I told you forget about that we were on the circle. Now let's remember that we're back on the circle again. So when we had a single magnon, okay, we said that e to the I p1 times L is equal to 1. In other words, what we did is we took the magnon and we took it all the way around the circle. Okay, that's what basically what that operation is telling you to do, and you say it's equal to 1. The wave function doesn't change. Now when I have two magnons and I pull one all the way around the circle, what happens? One of the magnons goes through the other magnon, okay? So the S matrix comes into play here. So actually with two magnons, the quantization condition for P1 is actually e to the I P1L times the S matrix is equal to 1, okay? Because you had the S matrix in this case is just the phase, okay? And so this is actually equal to 1. Okay, so if I go back and write things in terms of rapidity variables, I find that I can write this like this. And the convention is to bring this to the other side of the equation. So this would be the inverse of the S matrix, that this is equal to U1 minus U2 plus I, U1 minus U2 minus I. Okay? And then the same sort of quantization condition exists for U2. Okay, that would help. Yeah. Well, not right now. I'll probably lose it there. Okay, so the same sort of quantization condition would hold for U2. So I would just reverse the ones and the twos there. Okay, and so all I have to do is solve that equation, and I find the possible momenta for my magnons. And then I know their energies, because then I use this equation for the this expression here for the energy. I find P1, I find P2, I just plug it into there, and I know the energy of this state. Now here's the, okay, so here's the real magic, though, of this theory. And that comes when I put three magnons in. Now I won't go through the same assorted details, but what happens when you put in three magnons is you could consider an S matrix where I have one scattering with two, which scatters with three, okay? And what happens for this particular system is that it factorizes. Actually, this would be 1, 3. Into two-body scatter S matrices, okay? So if you can find the two-body ones, if you can find the two-body S matrix, then you know the scattering for any number of particles because it has this factorization problem. This is known as factorization. And there's a famous basically diagram that sort of describes this. So you can think of this as 1, 2, 3, and then this is the particles when they scatter. You know, depending on the momentum, it comes out like this, 3, 2, 1. Okay, so this would be the three-body S matrix. And what you say is that this would be equal to this S matrix, where you have 1, 2, and then you have 1, 3. Sorry, this is 3 here. So here would be the S1, 2. Here would be the S1, 3. And here would be the S2, 3. So 3, 2, 1 comes out like that. Okay, so that's what this means. Yes?
Can I explain where
this one? Okay, so you understand the first the first line. Okay, so basically, remember what the momentum operator does. The momentum operator translates you along the circle, right? So when I have e to the I p1l, it means I'm translating L sites around. So that takes me L sites. Okay, and then this is basically telling me when I act on the state e to the, that I should get back 1, okay, because it's the same thing. When I shift everything over by L sites, I come back to my original position, so the wave function should be the same. This one Okay, now there's a, when I bring the magnon all the way around, just think if I bring the downspin all the way around, it's going to hit, it's going to run it. It's in order to get all the way around, it goes through the other magnon. Okay, so it has to come with a factor of this S matrix. This is what that S matrix is telling you. So it gives you an extra phase when you go around the circle. Is that clear? Or okay. Yeah, there's a phase shift. Yeah, that's the phase shift. Yeah, and so now you can do one other thing. You can do one other operation here. You can bring this line, which is over here, and you slide it over to here, and so then you get this. Okay, so this would be 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1, and so what this tells you is that S12 times S13 times S23 is equal to S23 times S13 times S12. Now, in this case, this is sort of a trivial case because these are just phases and phases commute. But you can have more complicated systems where we basically only have one type of magnon. It's a downspin. Okay? But you can have more complicated systems with a magnon. There's different types of magnons. And so the S matrix really is a matrix, okay? And so this really is a non-trivial statement, okay? And this statement here is basically integrability. This is the statement of integrability, that you have this factorization of the S matrix. And if you have this factorization of the S matrix, it basically means you're going to have normally when you do some sort of scattering experiment, you basically only have a few conserved quantities, the total momentum, the total energy. In this case, you have lots of conserved quantities. Basically, each of the individual momenta are conserved. Okay, so this is the hallmark of integrability. You have this equation right here. This is actually a famous equation called the Yang-Baxter equation. Okay, and so solving this, if you have a Yang-Baxter equation, okay, you have an integrable system. So let me just say one more thing then. Assuming I have this factorization, let's assume I have M magnons, capital M magnons. Then what happens is that my quantization condition would be, let me write it like this. So for the J, number J magnon, to the L is equal to the product of all the different S matrices for the J with all the other magnons. So this would be K not equal to J up to M of UJ minus UK plus I, UJ minus UK minus I. So this is the solution to the Heisenberg spin chain. And this solution was written down right here. This was written down in 1931 by Beta. And it's called the Beta ansatz because Beta didn't prove it. He just assumed it. Okay, so an ansatz means, in a sense, well, I looked it up in Wikipedia this morning, what it really means in German, but it means the onset, I guess. But anyways, for us, it means an educated guess that more usually turns out to be right. Okay, so it's a starting point. Okay, and so by solving these sets of equations, you've solved the problem. Okay, so that's the integrability part. That's the integrability part. Now, so does anyone have any questions before I go on? Because I'm about to start the gauge theory part. Any questions? Yeah. Well, I mean, so I can, okay, so first of all, it works for the anti-ferromagnet. All I have to do is change the sign here. Okay, and that gives me any. But in that case, that's not usually the way you want to proceed because the ones where they're all lined up, that's an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, but it's the most energetic state of the Hamiltonian. So you're going the wrong way. So there are other, but you still use this beta ansatz to look at the anti-ferromagnetic case. We look at the ground state zero. In the anti-ferromagnetic case, the excitations are quite a bit different than this. So this equation for the energy of a magnon, this equation here. This is known as a dispersion relation. And a dispersion relation tells you the relation of the momentum to the energy, or the energy to the momentum. So if you plot this for, if you plot this for small p, okay, it's quadratic. Okay, so it's a quadratic dispersion relation. If you were to go to the antiferromagnetic case, and you looked at the dispersion relation above the ground state there, which is a totally different ground state than this one, you find that the dispersion relation is linear. So it's a completely different system. So, but I won't show that here. Other questions? Okay, so that's the integrability part. Now, this is a one-dimensional spin chain, and I'm about to tell you about a four-dimensional gauge theory. So the question is, what does a four-dimensional gauge theory have to do with a one-dimensional spin chain? Because integrability really, the only integrable systems really are one plus one-dimensional systems, or one spatial dimension, unless they're free theories, okay? But gauge theories are four-dimensional theories. They live in one time dimension plus three spatial dimensions. But we're going to actually see, or I'll try to show you in some pictures, that it's intimately related to this Betel ansatz. Okay, so I'm actually looking for the eraser. Oh, okay, yeah. I thought I remembered to keep it out, but I guess not. Okay, so so we're going to consider a particular type of gauge theory called n equals 4 super Yang Mills. Okay, and I'll try and explain some of these words as we go along here. Okay, so when you have a gauge theory, so I realize that many of you have never seen this before, so but you'll learn about it in October when you take the field theory course. Okay, what we have, is, as I told you before, is that the carrier of the force is a vector field. Okay, so in QED we have the photon, that's the carrier of the force. In QCD we have gluons. Okay, so but the case we're going to be considering is this Yang-Mills type theory, which QCD is an example of. Our gauge field, okay, actually comes with some charges, okay, and this index here, A, equals 1 to n. This is called a color index, okay, and so we're assuming that we have n different colors. And this index going down, this is called an anti-color index. So the big difference between QCD and QED, what makes QED much easier than QCD, in QED, the photon does not have a charge. So the photon doesn't directly interact with itself. In QCD, the gluon does have a charge. So gluons interact with themselves, okay, and they complicate the whole works. They follow everything up. Okay. Now, this theory that we're going to describe has, besides this field here, A mu, which is a spin one field. Okay, and whenever you see this mu here, this is the Lorentz covariant vector index. Whenever you see just one of these, you know it's a spin one field. We're also going to have a set of spin zero fields, which I'll label by phi I. And they also come with a color index and an anti-color index, AB. And this I runs from 1 to 6. And I'll try to give you some motivation for where this 6 comes from in a second. Hypermultiplets? You mean in n equal 2 theory, that hypermultiplet? Or no, that, no, 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 okay. No, the I is just a label, okay? It's not, but it's not part of the charge. It's just telling you you have 6 different fields. They're all alike, okay? And so it's just telling you you have 6 of these things. Then you also have some spin 1/2 fields. And this comes with, these also come with color and anti-color indices. And they also come with another index A, which runs from 1 to 4. And then there are anti-fields as well, which comes with an A bar index, which also runs from 1 to 4. OK, so if I count up all the number of fields, well, mu can run from 0 to 3, right? Because this is a Lorentz index. But actually, only 2 of them are physical. So there's 2 physical fields for the gauge field, 2 physical polarizations, if you will. You know, a photon has 2 polarizations. What's that? Yeah, the transverse ones, yeah. OK, so the transverse part are the only physical ones here. So there's 2 of these. There's 6 of these. OK, so that gives me 8. And I have 4 of these and 4 of these. OK, so 2 plus 6 is 8. The number of fermionic fields is 8. OK, so that means that there are 8 fermionic degrees of freedom and 8 bosonic degrees of freedom, because the spin 1 is a boson. Spin 0 is a boson. Spin 1/2 is a fermion. OK, and so the number of fermionic fields equals the number of bosonic fields. And so that tells you basically you have a supersymmetry. That's what the super refers to. And the 4 refers to the number of different types of these fields, this A running from 1 to 4. Okay, so that's where the 4 comes from. And it turns out that's the biggest amount of supersymmetry you can have. So this is the most supersymmetric gauge theory around. In fact, someone in a talk at the conference referred to this model as the hydrogen atom of gauge theories. It's the most simple, it's the simplest theory. Even though it looks complicated, the fact that it has a supersymmetry is a powerful tool. Okay, so now I don't feel bad if you don't quite understand what I'm saying. But just sort of keep in mind that you have this property called supersymmetry. And the supersymmetry tells you you have equal number of bosonic fields and equal number of fermionic fields. The other thing to keep in mind is all of these fields come with 2 indices. One's the color, one's the anti-color. OK, so then the thing about this theory is it's what's known as a conformal field theory. OK, there's no mass scale in the theory. There's no mass of the electron. There's no mass of a proton or anything like that. There's no intrinsic mass scale in this theory. There's no scale. So that means that if this were the real world, and we looked at this theory at the size of this room, OK, the physics would look exactly the same if we could blow it down to the size of a hydrogen atom, OK, and look at the physics there. So from that argument alone, you know that we do not live in a conformal field theory, because we know that the physics of a hydrogen atom is quite a bit different than the physics that we have in this room. Okay, so this is the property of a conformal field theory. Now, why would we want to study a conformal field theory if we know the real world is not conformal? It doesn't have the scale invariance. Well, the reason is because when you go to very high energies, okay, often what happens is the masses don't really matter, okay, because the energies you're putting in are much, much bigger than, say, the mass of the proton or the mass of the electron. Okay, at the LHC, okay, which has a 7 TeV, well, it has 3.5 TeV protons hitting each other, okay, the mass of the proton is 1 GeV, so it's 3,500 times smaller than its energy. So you can more or less forget about its mass. Okay, so it's almost in that sense. OK, so if we were studying, say, QCD at very high energies, QCD at very high energies is very close to a conformal field theory. So it makes some sense to study conformal field theories. OK, so So when you study a conformal field theory, what you're interested in are the physical operators. Okay. And actually, physical local operators. Okay, and the way you make a physical operator is this: the gauge index, this color, even though we call it color, the color is not actually an observable. Okay, so you know that you've probably heard that quarks come in three colors. They come in six flavors and three colors. Okay, I can tell you the flavor of a quark. I can't tell you the color because the color is not observable. It's not an observable. Okay, because you can do what's known as a gauge transformation. You change things around, you change the color. But a gauge transformation is not supposed to change the physics. Okay, so that means that the color is not observable. So the only thing that is observable that you can physically measure somehow is something that is gauge invariant. So the color is not seen. And one way to make the color not seen is basically to take any one of these fields, say phi 1 of AB, and then phi 2, and then what I do is I match that index with this index, the color index here with the anti-color index here, and then make C, phi 3, C. And if I keep going down, let's say I stop here. And then for this last one, I make this one the same as this one. And so what this means is I'm summing over all of these indices. Okay, and by doing that sum, I'm basically saying the color, I'm making the color unobservable. Okay, so what is this? How can you think of this? When I multiply these guys together, I take this index and match it with this index and sum over that index. I take this one and match it with this one and sum it over this one. And I take this one and match it with this one. What is this? It's a trace of them. That's exactly right. It's the trace of phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. And I'm assuming that I dropped it, but I'm assuming that they're all evaluated at the same space-time position. So that x goes for every one of those. So this is the trace of these fields, and this is an observable, if you can believe it. But it's an observable in the theory because it's gauge invariant. Okay, so so the other thing then. So now that we have physical operators, what we often study when we have physical operators, so if you become a condensed matter physicist, you do the same thing, you study correlators. So a correlator is you take your vacuum state, you take one of your physical operators, say at x, you take, say, the adjoint of that physical operator at y, and you see how this depends on x and y. Okay, now the fact that it's a conformal field theory actually tells you a lot. Also, the fact that it's translationally invariant tells you a lot. Okay, so since this theory is translationally invariant, it means that this correlator can only depend on the difference between x and y. The other thing that you know is that there's no scale in this theory. Okay, there's absolutely no scale in this theory. The only scale then in this correlator is given by the distance between x and y. So you know then that this thing has to be proportional to x minus y to some power. And I'll call that 2 delta. That's the only possibility. Now the question is, what is that power? And that power is basically determined by how many fields you have inside here. Okay. And so a field comes with a dimension, and it turns out a scalar has dimension 1. It has the units of mass. Okay, so if I have, say, if I have an operator with L fields, so if I take L scalar fields, so let's say this goes up to so phi I to the L, x like this, okay, L scalar fields, then this delta is equal to L plus something else. Okay. And that's just by dimensional analysis, I can tell you that. All right, so what we've spent basically the last decade doing is finding ways to compute this delta in this theory. Okay, because basically what it's doing is telling you the dimension of an operator, and telling you the dimension of the operator tells you a lot of information. And the way it works basically is that, so we know what the L is. What we care about is this little bit. And what you find happens is that when you start turning on, when you look for the little bit, what happens is that these correlate, that these the operators will mix with each other. Okay, so I can have, say, something I'll call I with something I call J. Okay, and this will give me something that gives me some gamma ij type term with some other stuff like that. Okay, so it's not diagonal once interactions start happening. So let me just sort of do the following. And so try and tell you how this links up with this. Suppose I consider this the following operator. Well, I have trace Z and W's and Z's, where Z is equal to 1 over the square root of 2 times phi 1 plus I times phi 2. So I take the first two of these six scalar fields like this, and I take W to be phi 3 plus I phi 4. Okay, I'll find in these correlators that the mixing to lowest order is exactly the same as this Heisenberg ferromagnet. Okay, and so the way I think about this is the Z fields, these are up spins. The W's are down spins. There's L of these fields in this trace to make a gauge invariant operator. The L fields in the trace, those are the L sites on the spin chain. And it turns out we can map this problem of finding these correlators to this problem of solving this problem to lowest order in the coupling that, because these are interacting fields, to lowest order. Okay, so that's one thing, but actually, we actually know what the beta equations are to arbitrary order in the couplings. And so these beta equations are beta equations for nearest neighbor interactions. As you go to higher and higher orders in the coupling, what happens is you get a spin chain where you get longer and longer interactions between the spins. Okay, so when you go to the next order in your computation, instead of having nearest neighbor interactions, you also have next to nearest neighbor interactions. And so you get this longer and longer interactions. And we know the beta equations for it. So if we can solve the beta equations, then we can find the spectrum of these operators. So we know the beta equations, but we actually don't know what the Hamiltonian is. So remember, I started off by writing down that Hamiltonian up there. We actually don't know what the Hamiltonian is for this particular theory. So one of the things we've been doing in this conference, of course, is discussing, you know, well, what do we do to find the Hamiltonian? Do we even care if we have the Hamiltonian? If we have the beta equations, if we can solve them, then we know the spectrum of these theories. Okay, so before I go, so that's the G. Well, my limo's not for another 50 minutes, so I have time for the S, if you guys are willing to hear the S. Okay. What's that?
I said we're all waiting here.
Okay. Okay, so let's go on to the S. Now, there's one thing I didn't yet tell you about this gauge theory. So I told you that I have a number of colors, okay, that's N. And actually, I'm going to make a further assumption about this N. N, believe it or not, the theory simplifies as you take n to infinity. So we're going to take n to infinity. This is known as the large n limit. And I'll try and show you why it simplifies. Okay. So in QCD, we have three colors. So the question is, so you can take the large n limit, you can assume that n is much greater than 1. So the question is, for QCD, can you say that 3 is much greater than 1? I don't know. It's close. You know. Okay, so is 3 much greater than 1? So it could be. And there's actually, there's a famous test of it that I can't reproduce right now, but makes it seem like it seems reasonable that you can consider 3 to be much bigger than 1. Okay, but in any case, we're going to take n goes to infinity. Now, why does that simplify things? Okay, so now that's mid. So mid down. Oh, you can't do them at the same time, I guess. Let's do that. Okay, so I told you about a gauge. I lost my eraser again. Oh, it's over here. I told you about a gauge theory, a specific type of gauge theory called n equals 4. So keep that in mind. But now we're going to go back to something closer to QCD. Okay, in that we will have quarks in this theory. And all I'm going to do is draw diagrams here. And I think hopefully it'll become clear what these diagrams mean. Okay, so the first thing you might consider is if you have a quark can scatter off of an antiquark. So a quark, we'll write as Q, and it comes with a color index, A, but not an anticolor index. That distinguishes a quark from a gluon. A gluon comes with a color and an anticolor. Then there's an antiquark, Q bar, and not surprisingly, that comes with an anticolor index, so we'll write that index down. Okay, so we can consider the scattering of a quark and an antiquark. So the way that these scatters is the gluon is sort of the carrier of the force. So you can draw a diagram called a Feynman diagram where we exchange, where a gluon is exchanged with the quark, and we'll have the quark arrow going this way. So this would be P1, this would be P2. The anti-quark will draw the arrow going back, okay, like this. And the gluon is exchanged. This would be P1 prime, P2 prime. And the gluon has some energy, has some momentum Q going through here. And Q has to be equal to, is equal to P1 minus P1 prime. OK, actually, these are 4 vectors, but I'm suppressing the 4 vector index. OK, and so if this is physical, you can actually convince yourself that Q squared, if I square it, So let me explicitly write what I mean by Q squared. I actually write the indices like this, that this will be less than 0. Okay, now a gluon is massless, and so it means that Q squared should equal 0. Okay, this has Q squared less than 0, so this is not a physical gluon. This is what's known as a virtual gluon. Okay, so it's emitted and it's absorbed by this guy, and in quantum mechanics, you know, you can have things that for a short period of time are exist and then go away. So that's the gluon. Now, I told you it has this index, this color index. This has an anti-color index. And the gluon has a color index and an anti-color index. So there's a way that people sort of keep track of these color indices. And these are known as bird tracks. Oh, and actually, there's a coupling associated with, I'll call it G, associated with the strength of the interaction. So every vertex here comes with the G. So these are known as bird tracks. So a quark only has one line, but a gluon has 2 lines, one for its color index and one for its anti-color index. And so I'll draw it like this. Okay, so one index is going down, and one index is going up. And you notice that the arrows follow the right way around the path here. These arrows follow this, and you notice that these arrows and these arrows match up with these arrows over here. Okay, so that's that. So you can think of it, if this had a color index going in, this index goes down through here through the gluon and comes out over here. This one has the outgoing one, okay, comes from going around this way. Now, I also told you that one thing that makes quantum chromodynamics, QCD, much more complicated than quantum chromodynamics, much more complicated than QED, is the fact that the gluons interact with each other. Am I all right? That the gluons interact with each other. So this is just one contribution to the scattering, this diagram I've drawn here. I could draw other diagrams as well, where I have a gluon like this, and it also did exchange the gluon before like this, or I can do where a gluon goes like this. And let me draw one more. Oops. Because I want to make a point here. Where the gluon here jumps over this line or goes under that line and attaches to that line over there. Okay, so let's draw this in using bird tracks. Let's do it without this line here. So if I do this with bird tracks, what you find is the following. Okay, and by the way, so each of these vertices come with a G. So I have a G, 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 G. Okay, I draw the arrows like that. And they go around like that. And you'll notice that what happened then with this particular graph here is that I have a closed loop inside here. Okay, the colors no longer match up. I have a closed loop. And what a closed loop tells you is that you sum over all the possible color indices. So that means that this graph will actually come with a factor of n for counting over those color indices. Because you just count over them, and there's n of them, so that gives you a factor of n. Okay, so the original one did not have a loop. So this was of order g squared because each of these comes with a g. This guy has 4g. So I'll write this as g squared times n, like that. And then let me do, I'm going to skip over to here. Okay, so then the next one would be, let me do one like, okay, I want to do two more, where it attaches like that. Okay, so this is this. Okay, so G, 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 G. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, yep. And there's two closed loops. So this comes with a factor of n, this comes with a factor of n. So this graph will be proportional to g squared times g squared n squared. Okay? All right, now let me do this one. Over here. Okay, now I gotta look at what I wrote here, so I don't mess it up. Okay, so if I do the bird tracks for this guy, what this corresponds to is I have something that looks like. Looks like this. Oops, wait. Oh, yeah. It looks like that. So I follow this guy around. And then you'll find that the rest of them if I follow this guy around, there's no loop. Okay, but there's the same number of vertices. There's six vertices. So this one goes as g to the sixth without the factor of n squared. I lost two loop factors. So what's the difference between this graph, say, and this graph right here? What did I have to do when I drew that? When I drew this thing, did you notice I was drawing around and I had to stop and go like that. It's non-planar, exactly. So it turns out that we will take the following limit. We will let n go to infinity. We'll let g become small. And we'll define a new quantity we'll call lambda, which is equal to g squared n. And so we see then that the planar diagrams will dominate over the non-planar diagrams. Because, OK, so this term is proportional to g squared times lambda. This one, OK, so with this definition, I can write this instead. I can write this as g squared times lambda squared divided by n squared. So this graph is down by a factor of n squared over this graph. So the non-planar diagrams are not as important as the planar diagrams when you take the large n limit. And that's why it simplifies. And so you all know the Euler number for a surface. Okay, you can find that this n squared, whatever your factor of n squared, if you draw that surface and sort of fill it out, that's telling you the Euler number. Whatever that power of n squared is, that's telling you the Euler number, basically, of your surface. So only the planar diagrams matter. All right, so now we're going to take this large n limit, and we'll take the large n limit. And we'll let lambda, OK, so we said lambda g squared n is our new quantity, and it's going to be finite. But it doesn't necessarily have to be small. So we'll let, say, lambda, say, be greater than or equal to 1. Well, if lambda is of order 1, then all of these planar diagrams I drew are equally as important. OK, so that means I have to consider lots and lots and lots of planar diagrams. So these are all planar. And what happens, basically, is you sort of, this quark and this anti-quark, when you consider their scattering, OK, they basically fill out this full sheet. Of these Feynman diagrams basically become dense, okay? And they basically fill out a sheet. So it starts looking like a sheet. So then if you say it starts looking like a sheet, the thing is sort of filling out, well, it's starting to look like a string that's propagating along, where one end of the string is the quark, and the other end of the string is the anti-quark, like here, and it starts to look like a string sweeping out in space. So anyways, so it was in this, so this large n limit was first formulated by a guy named Atoft. Is there anyone who's Dutch here? No one's Dutch, okay, because I can never pronounce his name. It's Atoft or something. But anyways, Atoft formulated this in the 70s. And he could see that it was like a string theory, but it was all very hand wavy. Okay. So the thing was, it looked like a string theory, but he couldn't really do anything with it. He said, OK, it looks like a string theory, but can I calculate with it? No. And the thing was also, this gauge theory, this large n gauge theory I've written down, lives in four dimensions. But you've probably heard, if you've seen on TV or something like that, heard from your professors before, that string theories like to live in 10 dimensions. So how can a 10-dimensional theory somehow be related to a four-dimensional theory? OK, so that brings us back to our gauge theory, the n equals 4 gauge theory up there. And this would be the final part of the talk, or my spiel here. But before I go on, does anyone have any questions on this? OK. So now I want to get a string theory. And we actually know how to get a string theory for that n equals 4 gauge theory. Basically, very little else, not QCD. Unfortunately, we don't know how to get a string theory for QCD, but we know how to get it for that n equals 4. And so I'll give you sort of a reason why, I'll sort of give you a motivation of why we get a 10-dimensional string theory out of this. Okay, so the first thing to look at is those scalars up there. There's 6 of them. So there's a symmetry in that theory by having the 6 scalars. All 6 scalars are basically the same as any other scalar. So what is that symmetry? Well, it basically means if I start with the phi 1, I can do a rotation into a phi 2, and it would basically be exactly the same thing. Okay, there's no difference between phi 1 and phi 2. Or I can do a rotation into a phi 3 or to a rotation into a phi 4. So what am I describing? I'm describing rotations in 6 dimensions. Okay, so what surface is invariant under rotations in 6 dimensions? Does anyone know? Okay, let me ask you an easy one. What surface is invariant under rotations in 2 dimensions? Wow, I meant the circle. Okay, the circle. Then in 3 dimensions, it's this 2 sphere. In 4 dimensions, it's the 3 sphere. In 6 dimensions, it's the 5 sphere. So somehow or other, there's some 5 sphere lurking around here. Okay, so now the next thing to understand is about these 6-dimensional rotations is how many independent rotations are there? So you know in 3 dimensions, there's 3 independent rotations, right? Those are the Euler angles, because you can do a rotation in one plane, or the xy plane, a rotation in the yz plane, and a rotation in the xz plane. In 6 dimensions, all you have to do is count the number of ways of choosing planes. So in 6 dimensions, it's 6 choose 2, which is equal to 15. So there's 15 independent rotations in 6 dimensions. OK, so that's half the story. And I mean it's half the story literally, because 5 is half of 10. OK, so it's half the story. Now what about the other half? Well, the other symmetry in this theory is, besides the supersymmetry, but let's not worry about the supersymmetry. The other symmetry in this theory is this conformal symmetry, this scaling symmetry. So let me count the number of different independent translations. So scaling is a one-dimensional thing. So I just blow everything up. Okay, if I expand everything in the same direction at the same rate, okay, that's one parameter that describes scaling. We also have Lorentz. It's also invariant under Lorentz transformations. And the number of independent Lorentz transformations is 6, right? Because you can have 3 different boosts in the 3 different directions. And you can have 3 rotations in the 3 spatial directions. So that gives me 6 Lorentz transformations. And also, there are translations. So I can translate in the x direction, y direction, z direction, or the time direction. So there's 4 of those. OK, and then there's 4 more mysterious ones called special conformal transformations. But I won't go into that. But special conformal. OK, so this is 1 plus 6 is 7, 11, 4 is 15. There's 15 independent generators of this conformal symmetry in 4 dimensions. 4 dimensions has 15 generators of conformal symmetries. The same number of generators as for S5. So the question is, what surface is invariant under these transformations? And it turns out that the surface that's invariant under these transformations is a surface called ADS5, which means anti-de Sitter space. In 5 dimensions. Okay, so one way I can describe this anti-de Sitter space is let me remind you how you can describe a 5 sphere. To describe a 5 sphere, what you can say is you have x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared all the way up to x6 squared is equal to r squared, the radius of the sphere. The way to describe ADS5 is you actually have 2 time directions, minus T1 squared minus T2 squared plus then, well, let me call, I call those x. So Y1 squared plus Y2 squared plus Y3 squared plus Y4 squared is equal to R squared. So it looks like the 5 sphere. All you've done is change two signs. And the R is what is the R for the 6 sphere? That's the radius of the sphere. And if I make R very big, the curvature of the sphere goes down, right? Because if you have a big sphere, like here we are on the Earth, okay, you can't see the curvature of the Earth. You make R small, the curvature goes up. The same is true for this ADS space, okay, that this R is related to that. So we have a five-dimensional space here. We have a five-dimensional space here. We take their tensor product, ADS5 cross S5. That's a 10-dimensional space. That's where our string theory lives. Our string theory is, it turns out that string theory on this surface, ADS5 cross S5, is equivalent, or at least we believe it's equivalent, to this N equals 4 gauge theory. Now, that's an incredible statement, because string theory is a theory of gravity. But there's no gravity in gauge theories. Okay? So we're saying a theory of gravity is equivalent to a gauge theory. So this proposal was put out by Maldacena in 1997, and it is now the most cited article in the High Energy Archive. So it gives you some idea of how much people work on this subject. This is the dominant sort of subject in theoretical high energy physics, is trying to figure out what this all means. Okay, so one further point, and then I'll stop. What's this R squared? How do we choose that R squared? Well, it turns out that R squared in our case, you're choosing appropriate units, is the square root of lambda. That lambda we wrote over here, this g squared times n. Now, as I make R big, the curvature goes down, and you know that gravity, if gravity is strong, you have large curvature, right? So if gravity is weak, you have small curvatures. So in the case where the gauge theory is strongly coupled, that means the lambda is big and I'm sweeping out these sheets like this, the corresponding string theory it's supposed to be equivalent to is weakly coupled, or the gravity limit of it is a weakly coupled gravity theory. So this means then that you can understand what happens at strong coupling. And we sort of argued why it should be like a string theory when lambda is big, because then we sweep out these sheets like this. Okay, but it's very hard to do this. You do these calculations order by order in these things here. Okay, but it's quite simple to do string theory calculations when the radius is very big, because it's almost like it's flat space. And we definitely know how to do string theory in flat space. So we can get information about our gauge theory by studying string theory like this. Not only that, we can see that I told you that we had integrability because we mapped it to a beta ansatz at weak coupling. This integrability we can show carries all the way up into the string region. Okay? In fact, this integrability is one way we've shown that this statement is true, that we can basically take lambda from small to big and we get what we expect. So anyways, that's what our conference has been about, is trying to understand this better. There's lots we don't understand. There's lots of people who work here who work on this subject. So I'm sure you'll get a chance to talk to them and the visitors who come by. Don't be afraid to bug them. They'll be more than happy to talk to you if you're interested. And well, thanks. Well, okay. It's up to you. I have 10 or 15 minutes. How many were completely overwhelmed? Okay. Well, it's sort of to give you a taste of what's happening. So.
I think, in a sense, this is why they're here.
Yeah, right, exactly.